Passage 55.
Custom has not been commonly regarded as a subject of any great moment. The inner workings of our own brains we feel to be uniquely worthy of investigation. But custom, we have a way of thinking, is behaviour at its most commonplace. As a matter of fact, it is the other way round. Traditional custom, taken the world over, is a mass of detailed behaviour more astonishing than what any one person can ever evolve in individual actions, no matter how aberrant. Yet that is a rather trivial aspect of the matter. The fact of first-rate importance is the predominant role that custom plays in experience and in belief, and the very great varieties it may manifest. No man ever looks at the world with pristine eyes. He sees it edited by a definite set of customs and institutions and ways of thinking. Even in his philosophical probings, he cannot go behind these stereotypes. His very concepts of the true and the false will still have reference to his particular traditional customs. John Dewey has said, in all seriousness, that the part played by custom in shaping the behaviour of the individual, as over against any way in which he can affect traditional custom, is as the proportion of the total vocabulary of his mother tongue, over against those words of his own baby talk that are taken up into the vernacular of his family. When one seriously studies the social orders that have had the opportunity to develop autonomously, the figure becomes no more than an exact and matter-of-fact observation. The life history of the individual is first and foremost an accommodation to the patterns and standards traditionally handed down in his community. From the moment of his birth, the customs into which he is born shape his experience and behaviour. By the time he can talk, he is the little creature of his culture, and by the time he is grown and able to take part in its activities, its habits are his habits, its beliefs, his beliefs, its impossibilities, his impossibilities. Every child that is born into his group will share them with him, and no child born into one on the opposite side of the globe can ever achieve the thousandth part. There is no social problem it is more incumbent upon us to understand than this of the role of custom. Until we are intelligent as to its laws and varieties, the main complicating facts of human life must remain unintelligible. The study of custom can be profitable only after certain preliminary propositions have been accepted, and some of these propositions have been violently opposed. In the first place, any scientific study requires that there be no preferential weighting of one or another of the items in the series it selects for its consideration. In all the less controversial fields like the study of cacti or termites or the nature of nebulae, the necessary method of study is to group the relevant material and to take note of all possible variant forms and conditions. In this way, we have learned that we know of the laws of astronomy or the habits of the social insects, let us say. It is only in the study of man himself that the major social sciences have substituted the study of one local variation, that of Western civilization. Anthropology was by definition impossible as long as these distinctions between ourselves and the primitive, ourselves and the barbarian, ourselves and the pagan held sway over people's minds. It was necessary first to arrive at that degree of sophistication where we no longer set our own belief over against our neighbour's superstition. It was necessary to recognise that these institutions which are based on the same premises, let us say the supernatural, must be considered together, our own among the rest. Ruth Benedict, Patterns of Culture. Passage 56.
Science and technology have come to pervade every aspect of our lives, and, as a result, society is changing at a speed which is quite unprecedented. There is a great technological explosion around us, generated by science. This explosion is already freeing vast numbers of people from their traditional bondage to nature, and now at last we have it in our power to free mankind once and for all from the fear which is based on want. Now, for the first time, man can reasonably begin to think that life can be something more than a grim struggle for survival. But even today, in spite of the high standard of living which has become general in the more fortunate West, the majority of people in the world still spend nearly all their time and energy in a never-ending struggle with nature to secure the food and shelter they need. Even in this elementary effort, millions of human beings each year die unnecessarily and wastefully from hunger, disease, or flood. Yet, in the West, science and technology have made it possible for us to have a plentiful supply of food, produced by only a fraction of the labor that was necessary even a few decades ago. In the United States, for instance, one man on the land produces more than enough food to feed 15 men in the cities, and in fact, there is a surplus of food grown even by this small proportion of the American labor force. We have considerably extended our expectation of life. We have enriched our lives by creating physical mobility through the motor car, the jet aeroplane, and other means of mechanical transport. And we have added to our intellectual mobility by the telephone, radio, and television. Not content with these advances, we are now thrusting forward to the stars, and the conquest of space no longer strikes us as Wellesian or Jules Vernian. And with the advent of the new phase of technology we call automation, we have the promise both of greater leisure and of even greater material and intellectual riches. But this is not inevitable. It depends on automation being adequately exploited. We shall need to apply our scientific and technological resources to literally every aspect of our society, to our commerce, our industry, our medicine, our agriculture, our transportation. It is fascinating and encouraging to observe the development of this immense process, a process in which man appears all the time to be engaged in the act of creating an extension of himself. In his new technological successes, this appears particularly true. He is extending his eyes with radar, his tongue and his ear through telecommunications, his muscle and body structure through mechanization. He extends his own energies by the generation and transmission of power, and his nervous system and his thinking and decision-making faculties through automation. If this observation is accurate, as I believe it is, the implications are far-reaching. It might be reasonable to conclude that the direction of modern science and technology is towards the creation of a series of machine systems based on man as a model. Leon Bagrat, The Age of Automation, from The Listener. Passage 57.
In man's early days, competition with other creatures must have been critical. But this phase of our development is now finished. Indeed, we lack practice and experience nowadays in dealing with primitive conditions. I am sure that, without modern weapons, I would make a very poor show of disputing the ownership of a cave with a bear, and in this I do not think that I stand alone. The last creature to compete with man was the mosquito, but even the mosquito has been subdued by attention to drainage and by chemical sprays. Competition between ourselves, person against person, community against community, still persists, however, and it is as fierce as it ever was. But the competition of man against man is not the simple process envisioned in biology, is not a simple competition for a fixed amount of food determined by the physical environment, because the environment that determines our evolution is no longer essentially physical. Our environment is chiefly conditioned by the thing we believe. Morocco and California are bits of the earth in very similar latitudes, both on the west coasts of continents with similar climates and probably with rather similar natural resources. Yet their present development is wholly different, not so much because of different people even, but because of the different thoughts that exist in the minds of their inhabitants. This is the point I wish to emphasize. The most important factor in our environment is the state of our own minds. It's well known that where the white man has invaded a primitive culture, the most destructive effects have come not from physical weapons, but from ideas. Ideas are dangerous. The Holy Office knew this full well when it caused heretics to be burnt in days gone by. Indeed, the concept of free speech only exists in our modern society because when you're inside a community, you are conditioned by the conventions of the community to such a degree that it's very difficult to conceive of anything really destructive. It's only someone looking on from outside that can inject the dangerous thoughts. I do not doubt that it would be possible to inject ideas into the modern world that would utterly destroy us. I would like to give you an example, but fortunately I cannot do so. But perhaps it will suffice to mention the nuclear bomb. Imagine the effect on a reasonably advanced technological society, one that still does not possess the bomb, of making it aware of the possibility of supplying sufficient details to enable the thing to be constructed. 20 or 30 pages of information handed to any of the major world powers around the year 1925 would have been sufficient to change the course of world history. It is a strange thought, but I believe a correct one, that 20 or 30 pages of ideas and information would be capable of turning the present-day world upside down or even destroying it. I have often tried to conceive of what those pages might contain, but of course I cannot do so because I am a prisoner of the present-day world, just as all of you are. We cannot think outside the particular patterns that our brains are conditioned to, or, to be more accurate, we can think only a very little way outside, and then only if we are very original. Fred Hoyle of Men and Galaxies. Passage 58.
A gifted American psychologist has said, "Worry is a spasm of the emotion. The mind catches hold of something and will not let it go." It is useless to argue with the mind in this condition. The stronger the will, the more futile the task. One can only gently insinuate something else into its convulsive grasp. And if this something else is rightly chosen, if it is really attended by the illumination of another field of interest, gradually, and often quite swiftly, the old and due grip relaxes, and the process of recuperation and repair begins. The cultivation of a hobby and new forms of interest is therefore a policy of first importance to a public man. But this is not a business that can be undertaken in a day, or swiftly improvised by a mere command of the will. The growth of alternative mental interests is a long process. The seeds must be carefully chosen. They must fall on good ground. They must be sedulously tended, if the vivifying fruits are to be at hand when needed. To be really happy and really safe, one ought to have at least 2 or 3 hobbies, and they must all be real. It is no use starting late in life to say, "I will take an interest in this or that." Such an attempt only aggravates the strain of mental effort. A man may acquire great knowledge of topics unconnected with his daily work, and yet hardly get any benefit or relief. It is no use doing what you like. You have got to like what you do. Broadly speaking, human beings may be divided into 3 classes: those who are toiled to death, those who are worried to death, and those who are bored to death. It is no use offering the manual labourer, tied out with a hard week's sweat and effort, the chance of playing a game of football or baseball on Saturday afternoon. It is no use inviting the politician or the professional or businessman who has been working or worrying about serious things for 6 days to work or worry about trifling things at the weekend. As for the unfortunate people who can command everything they want, who can gratify every caprice and lay their hands on almost every object of desire, for them a new pleasure, a new excitement, is only an additional satiation. In vain they rush frantically round from place to place, trying to escape from avenging boredom by mere clatter and motion. For them, discipline in one form or another is the most hopeful path. It may also be said that rational, industrious, useful human beings are divided into 2 classes. First, those whose work is work and whose pleasure is pleasure. And secondly, those whose work and pleasure are one. Of these, the former are the majority. They have their compensations. The long hours in the office or the factory bring with them, as their reward, not only the means of sustenance, but a keen appetite for pleasure, even in its simplest and most modest forms. But fortune's favoured children belong to the second class. Their life is a natural harmony. For them, the working hours are never long enough. Each day is a holiday, and ordinary holidays, when they come, are grudged as enforced interruptions in an absorbing vocation. Yet to both classes, the need of an alternative outlook, of a change of atmosphere, of a diversion of effort, is essential. Indeed, it may well be that those whose work is their pleasure are those who most need the means of banishing it at intervals from their minds. Winston Churchill, Painting as a Pastime. Passage 59.
Economy is one powerful motive for camping, since after the initial outlay upon equipment, or through hiring it, the total expense can be far less than the cost of hotels. But contrary to a popular assumption, it is far from being the only one, or even the greatest. The man who manoeuvres carelessly into his 5 shillings worth of space at one of Europe's myriad permanent sites may find himself bumping a Bentley. More likely, Ford Consul will be hub to hub with Renault or Mercedes, but rarely with bicycles made for two. That the equipment of modern camping becomes yearly more sophisticated is an entertaining paradox for the cynic, a brighter promise for the hopeful traveller who has sworn to get away from it all. It also provides, and some student sociologist might care to base his thesis upon the phenomenon, an escape of another kind. The modern traveller is often a man who dislikes the splendide and the bella vista, not because he can afford or shuns their material comforts, but because he is afraid of them. Affluent he may be, but he is by no means sure what to tip the doorman or the chambermaid. Master in his own house, he has little idea of when to say boo to a maître d'hôtel. From all such fears, camping releases him. Granted, a snobbery of camping itself, based upon equipment and techniques, already exists, but it is of a kind that, if he meets it, he can readily understand and deal with. There is no superior they in the shape of managements and hotel hierarchies to darken his holiday days. To such motives, yet another must be added. The contemporary phenomenon of motor car worship is to be explained not least by the sense of independence and freedom that ownership entails. To this pleasure, camping gives an exquisite refinement. From one's own front door to home or foreign hills or sands and back again, everything is to hand. Not only are the means of arriving at the holiday paradise entirely within one's own command and keeping, but the means of escape from holiday hell, if the beach proves too crowded, the local weather too inclement, are there outside, or, as likely, part of the tent. Idealists have objected to the practice of camping, as to the package tour, that the traveller abroad therefore denies himself the opportunity of getting to know the people of the country visited. Insularity and self-containment, it is argued, go hand in hand. The opinion does not survive experience of a popular continental camping place. Holiday hotels tend to cater for one nationality of visitors, especially, sometimes exclusively. Camping sites, by contrast, are highly cosmopolitan. Granted, a preponderance of Germans is a characteristic that seems common to most Mediterranean sites, but as yet there is no overwhelmingly specialized patronage. Notices forbidding the open-air drying of clothes, or the use of water points for car washing, or those inviting our camping friends to a dance or a boat trip are printed not only in French or Italian or Spanish, but also in English, German and Dutch. At mealtimes the odour of sauerkraut vies with that of garlic. The Frenchman's breakfast coffee competes with the Englishman's bacon and eggs. Whether the remarkable growth of organised camping means the eventual death of the more independent kind is hard to say. Municipalities naturally want to secure the camper's site fees, another custom. Police are wary of itinerants who cannot be traced to a recognised camp boundary or to 4 walls. But most probably it will all depend upon campers themselves, how many heath fires they cause, how much litter they leave. In short, whether or not they wholly alienate landowners and those who live in the countryside. Only good scouting is likely to preserve the freedom so dear to the heart of the eternal Boy Scout. Nigel Buxton, The Great Escape, from The Weekly Telegraph. Passage 60.
Although truth and justice may be the most powerful impulses to show moral courage, there are others. Compassion is one of these. Tentatively, it can be suggested that this is the main influence upon those who urge the abolition of capital punishment. It is recognition of compassion's part that leads the upholders of capital punishment to accuse the abolitionists of sentimentality in being more sorry for the murderer than for his victim. This is nonsense, but with it some organs of the popular press played upon the emotions of their readers so successfully that many candidates for Parliament were afraid to support abolition for fear of losing votes, and the result was the muddle-headed Homicide Act of 1957, which made murder with robbery a capital crime and allowed the poisoner to escape the gallows. That illogical qualification shows how flimsy is the argument that capital punishment is a deterrent to murder. The poisoner always works on a calculated plan of action, and therefore is able to consider whether or not his taking another's life is worth the risk of his own. The violent thief is usually at the mercy of an instant emotion. The only arguable plea for capital punishment is the right of society to retribution in this world with the prospect of life in another. But since what used to seem to the great majority of civilized humanity the assurance of another life beyond the grave has come to seem to more and more people less certain, a feeling for the value of human life has become deeper and more widespread. This may seem a paradoxical claim to make at a time when mankind is so much preoccupied with weapons of destruction. Nevertheless, it is a claim that can be sustained, and if compassion animates those who urge the abolition of the death penalty, it is not a sentimental compassion for the mental agony inflicted upon a condemned man, but a dread of destroying the miracle of life. When, in the 18th century, offences against the law that today would not earn a month in prison were punished with a death penalty, the severity of the penal code had no serious effect on the prevalence of crime. When it made no difference to the fate of a highwayman whether he had killed his victim or merely robbed him of a few pieces of silver, there were no more murders then than there were when men like Sir Francis Burdett succeeded in lightening the excessive severity of the penal laws. In those days, the sacredness of life on earth was not greatly regarded, because a life in the world to come was taken for granted, except by a comparatively small minority of philosophers. Nor was the long-drawn ordeal of the condemned cell inflicted either upon the condemned man or his jailers once upon a time. Those who believe in capital punishment may have arguments for its retention, but surely no reasonable argument can be found for retention of the sickening mumbo-jumbo that accompanies it from the moment that the judge dons the black cap with what looks like a pen wiper balanced on the top of his wig, to the reading of the burial service over the condemned man before he is dead. Moreover, it was more merciful to launch the condemned man into eternity 24 hours after he was sentenced than to keep him shivering on the brink of that dread gulf for nearly 3 weeks. Hanging is an atrociously archaic way of killing a human being, and the self-satisfied modernity of the electric chair is just as atrocious. The administration of a strong sleeping draught to the condemned man every night from which one night he does not awake seems a more civilized alternative to our present barbarous procedure, if capital punishment through the influence of backward minds be retained. Compton Mackenzie, On Moral Courage.